Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is July 16th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everybody. As we did last week, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Neil. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. I understand something we're going to talk a little bit about. That's Sarah Gideon up, or should I say down Maine where you are. There was a primary.
Right. Sarah Gideon won the Democratic primary, and she will take on Susan Collins.
Yeah, it's going to be nasty. We're going to talk about that. as always, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about on this podcast, please consider subscribing to our research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team at Hedgeye Risk Management, including Christian here. Google it. You'll figure out easily how to do it. Among other things, you will be able to get our newswire, all of our special reports, my show on COVID-19, which we just did earlier today, and special interviews with guests and all kinds of stuff like that. I will be leaving this weekend and will be gone the last 2 weeks of July. So, you know, you can expect silence until then, although we will be back at the very beginning of August and catch up on everything that's happened at that time. Our usual big agenda for today just covers a whole bunch of stuff. As usual, we'll start with markets and mainly positive U.S. economic indicators. We'll report a little bit on COVID-19 news, which for the U.S. has obviously not been positive. We'll talk a little bit about that. And along the way, actually report a bit about a piece we did for our newswire about growing pessimism about the pandemic in the United States and where that's going, both how that is going to ensure the continuation of stimulus, which now seems ever more certain, that is to say another phase of stimulus, which seems now more and more certain session of Congress before August, and also where stimulus goes. Talk a little bit about that. What dangers might it pose? So all of that, Trump's uphill battle, and the public's darkening mood. We will talk about the primaries in Maine and Alabama. And then before leaving U.S. politics entirely, we're going to talk about trouble among the Democrats. That is to say, the moderate Democrats versus their social justice warrior left. And that will, I think, the trigger for that is this incredible reaction to the letter to Harper's leading to the resignation of one of the top writers for the New York Times. This comes just 1 month after another editor left. We're going to get into that. But I'm going to offer my thoughts about liberalism and citizenship, and can they survive in this period of increasing polarization between ideological opposites and the kind of illiberalism of the current mood. So for what they're worth will be my thoughts. Then we're going to go into politics around the world, Hong Kong, Poland, Libya, and Russia. And finally, we hope to end with a piece that we did recently on amateur candidacies in the GOP. Is the Republican Party becoming the party of the outsider, right? Do you have to be an outsider in order to win an election? It's certainly the Democrats are certainly not the party of the outsider. And so I think each party sort of prides itself on that role, right? Democrats are the expertise and experience, and Republicans increasingly bragging about their lack of expertise and experience. Okay. With that, How? Even just going over the summary. I'm already exhausted, Kristen, you know. With that, though, we're going to move right into markets. And maybe you could tell us what's happened over the last, what is it, 6 days, 7 days, 6 days?
7 days now. Okay. Yeah. Well, markets are just slightly up. So over the last seven trading days, the S&P 500 is up 1.5% and the global Dow is up 1.6%. As for volatility, the VIX closed yesterday at 27. That's where it was last week. It's been hovering in that mid-high 20 range for almost a month now, I think. But if we ready to move right on to indicators, Neil, we got for June, the NFIB Business Optimism Index. So in May, that was at 94, and for June, it's come in at 100.6. So this is getting much closer in line to its levels before the pandemic. Now, a lot of this survey results probably came in the beginning of June, so you're not seeing it reflect the uptick in COVID cases we have been seeing. So for July, this number could come back down. So we also got industrial production for the U.S. month over month. Now, that rose 5.4% for June. That is its largest increase since December of 1959. But, Neil, year over year, it's still down 10.8%. So short-term rise, long-term, still nowhere near where it was. We got manufacturing production month over month. That came in at 7.2% for June, another pretty large rise. And we just today got retail sales month over month, which was 7.5% for June. And that, interestingly enough, Neil, if you look into what was pushing that rise, it was clothing stores. They are up 105% for June month over month.
Well, that's up from the dead, I might say, right?
Right.
So
right. Year over year, it's still down quite a bit.
Yeah, I guess people are finally beginning to go outside, if only to parks and stuff like that. Maybe not all that much back to work.
Right.
I think this is the best we'll do for monthly indicators for a while, because I guarantee you it's not going to look nearly so good in July. And that kind of a segue into my next thing, and that is what's happening to COVID-19. We've had rising cases ever since the middle of June. They've been rising steadily. We just came in yesterday at over 71,000 cases. People used to disbelieve Anthony Fauci when he said we were going to hit 100,000. I think that seems easily believable now. Maybe slowing slightly. Although, well, certainly not yesterday. It was up again. Certainly, 7-day averages are up. And more ominously, but we predicted this. Anyone who follows my COVID report, we predicted that after about 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, given the increasing lag on testing, we would see deaths rise. And that's exactly what we've seen. Since the 7-day average deaths, which really hit its low point at just over 500, it's now up above 750. So we've seen about a 50% rise in deaths on trend since its low point. So we're, you know, we already see this reflected in declining mobility. Increasingly, you know, the workplace mobility is down. We're still at 41% below where we were in January, early February. So the United States isn't doing well on that. I believe we have now, what was it, Christian, 11 states who are now actually backing away from reopening. We have a larger number of states who are now completely stalled. I mean, the only part of the country now which is still in reopening mode is basically the Northeast, which used to be so high and has been shut down much harder for much longer. It'll be interesting to see whether they also have a blowback from that. The mood of America from all this is not good. And I believe we reported a couple of weeks ago, we did a piece on just how unhappy America is. Going back, this is Chicago's National Opinion Research Center. They couldn't find a time when Americans were as unhappy as they are now, not only just personally being cooped up all the time, but about their country. Record shares of Americans are saying that their kids won't inherit the same standard of living that they have when they get to be their age. A record share of Americans are saying they're not proud to be Americans. They believe America's on the wrong track. You can go down all that. But it's also showing up now very concretely in people's perception of how COVID is doing. From late May to late June, according to a poll taken by the Financial Times and the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, the share of Americans who say the pandemic is getting worse in their community rose from 35% to 49%. The share saying getting better in their community dropped from 39% to 25%. And regionally, the trends are what you'd expect, right? The biggest rises in the West and the South. The East was the only region in which better was slightly higher than worse. So that's just kind of common sense, given what you see on the map. Gallup reports the same thing. A steep rise in the share of Americans who say that coronavirus is getting worse nationally from 30% at the beginning of June to 68% today. Similarly, a declining share that says getting better, and also a declining share who say in the absence of public restrictions that they would return to normal activity now. A rising share say they will wait until a vaccine is developed. Ditto, according to the Economist YouGov poll. That's the one done by, in London. That's the UK group. An impressive 70% of Americans now agree that daily new cases will continue to increase. 47% say the worst is still ahead of us, while only 19% say it's behind us. And here's another one. NBC News Survey Monkey, 63% say businesses are reopening too quickly. Only 33% said too slowly. A sizable majority, 57 to 32%, supports closing state economies again. Wow. Asked when it would be safe to reopen the economy nationally, I'd say about 60% say several months or a year or longer. So there you go. Unsurprisingly, given this darkening outlook on the pandemic, medium-term views on the economy are beginning to get worse again. Over the last month, according to the FT, the share of Americans who think the economy will recover within a year has dropped from 42 to 37%. Well, it's not a big drop, but it's certainly not going in a positive direction. The share saying more than a year rose from 58 to 63%. The biggest problem that people, if you ask them what about the economy they fear, it's the global slowdown. And obviously, though the question was not asked, the spread of the pandemic at home. Benefits, that is to say, an extension of the CARES Act provisions, particularly in terms of PPP, it replaced payroll, the unemployment insurance bonus, and all the rest. Overwhelmingly, Americans want them extended. Roughly 50% of Americans strongly support extension. Less than 10% strongly oppose. And I think Christian, you can take from that the lesson that party leaders on both sides need to be careful about how they negotiate an agreement on further stimulus before the August recess. Neither side will want to be blamed for failure to come to an agreement. And, right. You know, what is that agreement going to be? Well, the as many of you already know, the HEROES Act, supported by the House Democrats, is about $3.2 trillion stimulus package. The total GOP proposal is probably going to be around $1.2 trillion. They will compromise with the Democrats to maybe $1.5 or $2 trillion. At $2 trillion, this would add another 10% of GDP to the national debt. But who's counting, right? I mean, does anyone care anymore? We probably will get a smaller unemployment insurance bonus, maybe $400, maybe $350. We may also get a back-to-work bonus, thanks to the Republican senator from Ohio. And we'll probably get a new round of stimulus checks. I mean, those are always popular. But I think Rob Portman's idea is an interesting one. We're going to get back to work bonuses at the same time we have unemployment insurance bonuses. Well, at least we neutralize the incentives to stay home, right? We'll just give money to everybody. And I think a lot of people wonder, where do we go with all the stimulus? I mean, can we continue to add to the debt? After all, the Fed can monetize it, I suppose, if necessary. The obvious downside, I think the most immediate one, I don't mean immediate time-wise, but I mean the one that's most forcing in terms of action, is inflation, which in this case, I think you'd fairly call it stagflation, since the GDP numbers will still be, or sales or PMIs will still be down year over year. But it will be stagflation. And we're beginning to see signs of that already, right? Industrial metals and agricultural commodities are up. Gold is steadily climbing up. The U.S. dollar is just continuing now to trend down after being very high back in March when the crisis first hit. A lot of people wondered whether there'd be a real squeeze on the emerging market economies. Now everyone's relieved it's falling the other way. But this does definitely lead to the specter of inflation. The 10-year break even, this is the gap between the TIPS, inflation-adjusted treasuries, and the nominal 10-year treasury bond, was below 1.0% percentage point for much of April and March. It is now back to 1.4. Remember, we were at 1.5 or 1.6 through last fall. So that's remarkable. People's, you know, outlook on inflation certainly seems to be warming. And I don't know. It's an interesting one to think about. I often remind people that this has been one of the oddest recessions that I can think of in one respect. That is to say, the extreme magnitude of the decline in employment and income on the one hand, which is historic by almost any measure, particularly when you measure in the speed, it's probably the biggest in history, right? How fast we've had this enormous drop, both in employment and output. And yet, most middle-class Americans have been shielded from any appreciable harm in their income and net worth. In April and May, disposable personal income actually climbed. And according to some estimates, the national poverty rate in April and May, and I'm certainly going to report on this because I think the data is fascinating, may actually have fallen. I mean, think about that. A falling poverty rate in the worst recession in living memory. I mean, clearly there's a lot of stimulus out there, and it's not all going to the well-to-do, although certainly, you know, most of what the Fed is doing is protecting the well-to-do. It's going everywhere. And as I explained in the piece we did a couple of weeks ago on how unhappy most Americans are, this protection from a hit to income and wealth, while certainly welcomed, is not making Americans feel any better at all about their future or about, you know, how they feel America's doing. According to Pew, and this was very recent data that just came out, 71% of Americans now say that thinking about the state of their country makes them angry. I mean, that's the word, angry. They're given a list of words. That's the one they choose. Only 17% say the word proud. By at least a 2-to-1 ratio, every demographic group, age, gender, race, party, agrees that coronavirus has divided rather than united America. Now, on the one hand, I will say this, because of the stimulus, and I think Trump has a good instinct here, because of the stimulus, people still give Trump a high rating on the economy, more than any other aspect of his leadership. In fact, it's the one issue where he comes out better than Joe Biden. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, Donald Trump is known as, you know, Mr. Leverage Bailout. I mean, you know, trust Trump to either stimulate the economy or keep stimulating even when we're not producing. But in any case, we all feel good economically, apparently, when it just comes to, you know, how we're doing in our you know, balance sheet, our financial assets, or our income. On the other hand, here's the downside for Trump, right? Is that most Americans feel just terrible about where this country's going and about what's happening to America. And that is, you know, that when Americans feel that bleak about the future, that has to redound poorly on the incumbent president. And keep in mind that other than leadership on the economy, in practically every other respect, most Americans do not like Trump's leadership. As the expected duration of the pandemic and recession grows longer, we're going to see, you know, more Americans, you know, taking this very, you know, this very negative outlook. Right now, I think we usually track this day to day, but in the presidential race, he's still 13 percentage points. Well, I'd say in approval, right? He's 13 percentage points down. And then against Biden, this is a new Wall Street Journal poll that just came in yesterday. He's now 11 points behind Joe Biden. And that's down from 17 points negative last month. So that isn't good. In the futures markets, Trump is now 21 percentage points behind Biden. Futures market, basically, you buy a future. You know, you can buy a Biden future for $1, a Trump future for $1, and it's, you know, you get paid $1 if he wins. Well, how much do you pay for that future? Well, you can buy a Trump future right now for 38 cents, or you can buy a Biden future for 59 cents. So that gives you a pretty good, almost a very precise idea of how people are thinking about the probabilities. So in that context, we had some primary runs. We had one run in Alabama where Jeff Sessions was defeated very soundly, 61% to 39%, by Tommy Tuberville, former Auburn football coach with zero political experience. And so it will be Tommy Tuberville, who is a Trump favorite. Obviously, Jeff Sessions was definitely not Trump's favorite. In fact, Trump campaigned vigorously against Jeff Sessions, just cannot get enough of beating up on Jeff. Tommy Tuberville will run against Democratic Senator Doug Jones, and he has a good chance of winning because obviously Democrats do not often win in Alabama. And those of you who remember the election, Doug Jones came in on a fluke. A very ineligible Republican was in there, and Doug Jones won. That is the one race, by the way, where Republicans are likely to pick up one senator come this fall. But Tommy Tuberville is an interesting case. He's just a total Trump guy. I mean, this is the kind of candidate that Trump loves. Tuberville accused Doug Jones of having, and I quote here, New York values, Chicago values, liberal Democrat values. I guess that's all just kind of redundant, right? I mean, and then he went on to say, Trump is the best president of my lifetime. Okay, so that's it. I mean, Trump loves this guy, right? Here is the words of a Republican strategist in Alabama, Angie Stalnaker, who said that people in Alabama voted against Jeff Sessions because Donald Trump told them to. If it had been Donald Trump saying, go write in Mickey Mouse, 50% of them would have gone on to write in Mickey Mouse. So there you are. And this actually gets to something I hope we have time to talk about later, and that has to do with the increasing tendency of the GOP to run complete political outsiders. Trump obviously loves this because these people are completely dependent on him, right? I mean, Trump prefers loners, outsiders who have no other connections, who have no other peer support, no other political identity. So there you got it. And then you have where you are, Christian, Sarah Gideon. She's an Xer, born in 1971, kind of an ordinary housewife, but also a wily professional who, you know, kind of like Cincinnatus, put down her career and decided to go into politics to slay some dragons. And she is very popular. I mean, she beat all of her challenges, and she will face Senator Susan Collins, the sole remaining Republican senator in New England. You know, this red zone, this red zone, blue zone is really becoming regional, isn't it?
Right.
Collins refuses to say if she will vote for Trump. I mean, that's how Collins is on the defensive, right? She won't even say if she'll vote for Trump. Needless to say, Collins, you know, may not, you know, be Trump's favorite senator, but I mean, he needs her, right? So no one else is going to run in Maine and have the capacity to win the seat. And Gideon has raised a lot of money. In fact, she has raised a lot more money than Susan Collins, who's been there for a long time, right? And we're going to get to this, and I want to ask your opinion about it, Christian. But, you know, Colin, you know, I've met her, talked with her. She is this very reasonable, very centrist person. She loves seeing two sides of issues. She is extremely uncomfortable with the polarization of politics. I mean, it's no wonder. I can't imagine her being Trump's favorite person. And I think nothing is more painful for her that she is in the middle of this hugely polarized culture wars over things like the decision to go ahead with Brett Kavanaugh, for example, on the Supreme Court. And clearly she's tainted, as many moderates are, by being tools of big money interests such as big pharma or big banks. And as many of the Democrats are now doing, obviously they'll take plenty of help from the big PACs, but they are not accepting direct donations from some of these donors. How does this race, how do you size up this race? You're in Maine.
I say it's a race of two very different styles. There are a lot of attack ads from Gideon against Collins. But as you said, Neil, Collins is a very moderate. You know, she'll kind of have these roundabout ways to criticize Gideon. Like, I think the other day she said, because Sarah Gideon, if you don't know, is the Speaker of the Maine House. She had some comment like, oh, I'm shocked that the Maine House hasn't met since March. You know, not really calling out Gideon by name, but these roundabout ways of attacking each other. And yeah. I have never seen so many ads for a Maine Senate race in my life. And it's getting funded by a lot of outside money on both sides.
Yeah, well, this is, again, it's every Senate seat counts, right? It's going to be very close. Right. I think everyone is saying this could be just one Senate seat away from one party or the other taking control.
Exactly.
We're going to have to see. You know, we're going to have to see how that comes down. And but you're absolutely right. Susan Collins does not exactly go for the juggler, you know, when it comes to street fighting. But that actually takes us. We've been talking a lot about Donald Trump's problems politically. But you can always trust, you know, when Republicans are in trouble, you can always trust, you know, Democrats to get into a lot of problems of their own. And I have in mind here the increasing bitter antipathy and problems breaking out between the moderates of the Democratic Party and their left, particularly their left on kind of cultural issues. And this is the letter and the outbreak and the resignation of Barry Weiss from the New York Times. Maybe you can go through that and tell us a little bit about what the language of that letter was and what was behind it.
Right. So this letter came out, Harper's Magazine, signed by 150 pretty much liberal academics, journalists, you know, writers. And the idea of it was that they were saying cancel culture is bad for the free exchange of information ideas, and saying it's constricting debate and toleration is going out the window. And very liberal people signed this, Neil. It you would never say this was a conservative document. You know, Noam Chomsky was on it, Malcolm Gladwell, Rushdie signed it, and there was even a paragraph in it that was very specifically anti-Trump, pretty much calling him an authoritarian. But a lot of liberals thought that this was a insulting letter, and it resulted in Barry Weiss, you know, opinion writer at the New York Times. She claimed that after she signed it, she got bullied by her colleagues, and they said that her attack on social justice warriors was terrible, and she quit because she said it was a terrible work environment.
Yeah, I will have to say, I mean, some people, I'm just looking over the list right now. Noam Chomsky, he's not liberal. I mean, he's on the left. I mean, some of these right. people are out and out left. It's really surprising. I mean, you know, some of these people, yeah, they're kind of your moderate, you know, Fareed Zakaria and Gary Wills. I mean, how liberal do you want? I mean, some of these people used to be known as real progressives. I mean, a few of them, you might say, are sort of moderate liberals. Definitely, you could say, right. well, maybe they're sort of very reasonable. You might even say have a little bit of neoconservative streak. But I think you could say, in general, this is a very progressive liberal. No question. Let me just put it this way to make it clear to everyone. No question that 4/5 of these people vote for the Democrats. I guess maybe that's the bottom line, right? I mean, there's no question about it. I can't imagine most of these people not regularly voting for Democratic candidates. And in fact, they had one paragraph that was all about the dangers of populism. But where they did something that was inexcusable is they came back and said, on the other hand, as we fight populism, we need to make sure that we do not go so far as to stifle, you know, freedom of speech and the free, you know, free debate of ideas and for people to actually make sure that they're free to talk and speak reasonably on different points of view. The way to defeat bad ideas is by exposure, argument, and persuasion, not by trying to silence or wish them away. Well, I guess that's extremely unwelcome today, right? Now this
radical thought,
a radical idea. Well, it turns out, and this is where I'm going to go. You'll see at the end of my little piece on this. Actually, it turns out that the whole idea of free speech is the real radical idea, because it's the rarity in history. Right? Only a few societies in history have achieved what we try to achieve, which is, you know, the maintenance of an arena where people feel free to speak no matter what ideas they have, to maintain a rational dialogue or trialogue or how many people are talking. This came at the New York Times just 1 month after James Bennett resigned, who is right. the one of the top editors, but he had the temerity to allow the publication of Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton's op-ed piece. Now, and it was considered so vile, so horrible, that it was offensive to New York Times readers. They said, we were harmed by this piece. You needed some sort of a special alert, you know, or something, or you know, some special warning, right? Because people were harmed, emotionally harmed by reading this piece. This is a U.S. senator, right? I mean, just you think about that, right? Last time I looked, Arkansas was still part of the United Nations. Now, God knows, that may not last. You know my thoughts on fourth turnings, Christian. but this is a U.S. senator, and is the publication of a piece by him in the New York Times was considered so harmful that the editor had to resign. Anyway, The Economist came out with an op-ed, not with an op-ed, actually the cover of their issue was a big headline. It said, Enlightenment liberalism is losing ground in the debate about race. And it just made me think a little bit about a wonderful book. For those of you who have not read it, it's called The Coddling of the American Mind. This is by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff. Jonathan Haidt is a wonderful writer. He did a book called The Righteous Mind. And it's the subtitle is Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. He's done wonderful work on societies all around the world and why people have certain moral categories. What are the basic moral categories of different societies. Why do we have them, and why are they stronger in some people than another? Anyway, wonderful researcher, a very articulate writer. And in this book, The Coddling of the American Mind, which is particularly an attack on this new shutdown, you know, shutdown culture, you could say, that's going on in academia, they unveiled three untruths, which I love. And you can see this is a little bit making fun here. This may be a little millennial alert, right? So, you know, just warning you, you know, something unpleasant may be coming up here. But here are the three untruths. They say the first untruth is the untruth of fragility. That is, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. The second is the untruth of emotional reasoning. Always trust your feelings. And the third is the untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good and evil people, right? And the point that both Hayden and Lukianoff make is that all three of these things are a guaranteed recipe, first of all, for emotional unhappiness. Almost every moral philosopher and, in fact, modern cognitive behavioral therapy tells you that following all of these rules is guaranteed to make you an unhappy person. Right? I mean, if you do these things, I mean, always trust your feelings. Thinking about life as a battle always between good and evil people, never just seeing people objectively, is perhaps a mix of the two. Anyway, doing all those things guaranteed to make you miserable. But it's also antithetical to a liberal society, right? It leads to and is consistent with a totally polarized political environment of the sort we see today. I would just add, with three additional sort of tenets of postmodernism that you see today in critical race theory, critical gender theory, I mean, all the modern academic trends that are now very popular among the left in academia. And I would say that, well, I'll just go through the three. The first is what I call status ascription, and that is your status ascribed to you by race, ethnicity, religion, gender, or other factors beyond your control are what essentially define you, right? And that is, they put you into structural conflict, which is similarly beyond the power of civil society to control. So you will be judged for your membership to these groups, regardless of any choice you make or any value judgment you make, right? If you're privileged, your only option is to confess your guilt. And this is one of the central tenets of anti-racism, which, I mean, all of the implications of this idea are profoundly pessimistic, that we're all at war with each other. We're defined by our group. And it's really beyond the power of individuals to transcend that. And therefore, you know, we have to, the most important thing we have to do is to sort of confess our membership to this group, and to the extent we're at fault because of these things that are ascribed to us. The second is microaggression. And there's a wonderful section in Jonathan Haidt and Lukianoff's book on microaggression. And the idea of microaggression is whatever you say or do should be judged by how the hearer or watcher interprets it, not by how you intended it, right? So if you say something that you didn't intend to be harmful, but someone is harmed by it, you are to be judged to, you know, feels harmed by it, you are to be judged accordingly, right? And again, you can understand how this follows from status ascription. You're guilty for who you are, not what you intend, right? So you're judged according to who you are. It makes no difference what you intend. And as Haidt and Lukianoff explained, this is absolutely designed to make everyone furious at each other. And there is no chance that this will ever lead to intelligent or reasoned conversation. What you ought to say, if you're offended by someone, is you ought to say, well, you know, that was offensive to me, and here's how. And then the other person says, well, I'm glad you told me, because I did not intend it that. You understand what I mean? A constructive conversation. This totally shuts down constructive conversations. And I see that happening all the time on campuses, right? We see a lot of millennials. They just don't talk. And if there's one reason why liberal arts and the social sciences, and in fact, a lot of the arts and humanities, are becoming profoundly unpopular among millennials on college campuses, this is one of the biggest reasons. People feel they can no longer talk in the classroom. They no longer have the privilege to speak, right? Finally, intersectionality. Those whom the system most disempowers should be given the most power. Well, again, this is actually paradoxically when you say it that way. Well, if you're disempowered, then you have the most power. Well, you know, then you're no longer disempowered anymore, right? How's that going to work? Well, I guess you don't have a system anymore. And that's the other problem with postmodernism. How can you have a system? A system assumes that through election or some sort of system whereby people are summoned to leadership positions, people have to exercise power. Authority has to be exercised in any society, right? But it throws all of that into confusion as well. I guess my final observation is that the whole premise of a liberal democratic society is not that different backgrounds don't exist or are unimportant. I think they are. I think we all come from different parochial backgrounds, you know, whether it's race, ethnicity, religion. No question it shapes us. In fact, I would go further than that. And here I totally agree with postmodernists. I think it's very important about our collective self-esteem, how good we feel about our lives, that we feel good about the group we come from. So I have no problem with that. But here's the problem. No matter what background we come from, we do our best to transcend them when dealing with each other as citizens. So this is the key to a liberal democratic republic. And indeed, it's the key to civilization. Aristotle laid it out perfectly back in the Politics. He wrote in the 4th century BC. He said, when defining the difference between belonging to a family or a tribe, or, you know, whatever other atavistic social organization there was, as opposed to being a citizen, that was the difference. Citizens interact with each other on the assumption of equality. Equality, right? They choose to treat each other as equals. And obviously, two people aren't literally equal to each other. Everyone's different. But we pretend for the sake of citizenship that it should exist for some large sphere of rights and privileges. And that idea of equality as an abstraction is something we aspire to. And I think that's, you know, something we've seen. I think the West rightly takes pride of that. So treating group differences as essential makes the whole idea of equal citizenship, idea and ideal of equal citizenship impossible. And I will say that treating group differences as essential is the norm historically. The liberal ideal is not the norm. That's the exception. And my last comment is this lurch toward illiberalism will inevitably be the hardest on minorities. Look around the world today. I often say this too. I have friends on the left, and I just tell them, look around the world and find out who's going to suffer when we no longer are a liberal society. Liberalism protects minorities, right? And you look around the United States today, you know, anyone can think racially, not just minorities, right? I think we do ourselves all an active disservice when we don't think about that. Liberalism is wonderful, particularly for preserving genuine diversity and protecting those who are, for whatever reason, unpopular. All right, so enough of that. Let's move on here. We have, I'm going to go into, I think we have a number of political things that we promised to do up front. I think the first is our update on Hong Kong.
Right. So, Neil, Trump has officially signed the Hong Kong Autonomy Act. And what this act does is it gives the executive branch 90 days to make a list of Chinese officials who helped undermine the independence of Hong Kong. And now, Congress must also be informed of any financial institutions that knowingly help these officials. And within 1 year, Trump must sanction all individuals and institutions on this list. Now, there's a little bit of confusion whether Congress can actually force Trump to put these sanctions on, whether they have that power over the executive branch. But so we're not really sure if Trump's going to use this power. I will say, last week, he did put sanctions on additional Chinese officials over the Uyghur detention camps in China.
Yeah, he did that with the Global Magnitsky Act, right? That was a different piece of legislation.
Yeah. 2016 Act. Yeah, exactly.
So he has already, I will say as well, he has already declared that Hong Kong will no longer receive any trade benefits or technology benefits. They will be treated as a part of China, right? So the whole trade aspect of China's special status has already been formally pulled away. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So, yeah.
And there was a, or just to add, Neil, there was a survey done recently by the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong, and 35% of U.S. companies in Hong Kong are already planning on moving their assets out of the city.
Yeah, and their assets and and something else as well. Yes, I think they're planning to move everything out. I think Google and all the social media are obviously dismantling. I was in Hong Kong recently, and as we all know, I mean, Hong Kong, you know, enjoyed all the same openness, social media, as the rest of the world, and that's rapidly being all shut down, right?
Right.
So China then stuck saying, you know, always tit for tat, right? China slapped sanctions on Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and a couple of other house, I think one house member and someone else who was in charge of some human rights agency. It's interesting. I don't think China really understands sanctions. There's something fundamental about the whole idea of a sanction and how why the West implements it that China just doesn't get. They slaps Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz with these sanctions for speaking up against China, right? And they just don't get it. The Westerners don't put sanctions on speaking, right? You have freedom of speech. This kind of gets back to what I was just saying, right? This is what a totalitarian culture says, right? You get slapped with sanctions for what you say. They don't get it. The West is slapping sanctions on what people do for official actions they make. My gosh, I just want to shake them. But anyway, Ted Cruz, his response, I think he tweeted out after being sanctioned by China, was, "Bummer, I was going to take my family to Beijing for summer vacation right after visiting Tehran." So anyway, there we have it. But we will see. And by the way, as long as you're at it, I think we have a couple of economic indicators to report out of China, right? They're generally very positive.
Yeah, there was a big surprise that exports year over year were up 0.5% in June. And now what this is actually being fueled by is they're selling face masks and other medical equipment for COVID to all these countries that are seeing spikes now. But in general, their exports have been pretty terrible, and this was the first positive growth since COVID. But maybe even more importantly, we got China's GDP year over year for Q2, and that was positive at 3.2%. Now, Neil, a lot of this was, I believe, kind of because of infrastructure projects, because retail was still falling.
Right, and they obviously are going to be way down for the year, and they will be technically in recession, which is two quarters. But it's interesting, the masks. I've got a KN95 respirator, by the way, and it's the Chinese version. You know, in the West, they just can't make enough of them. So, China, well, this was the result of SARS back in 2003. I mean, I've been through a lot of this on my COVID call, but basically all of that area of the world was already pre-prepared for a pandemic, and the West wasn't prepared at all. So China was ready to go with all this. Okay, let's move on to Poland. What's happening there?
Well, Poland just had presidential elections. It was Andrzej Duda was running for re-election. He's this pretty internationally controversial president. He's very conservative. He's part of this kind of nationalist law and justice party. He's a lot of his time in power, he's stripped the judiciary in Poland of a lot of its power. And this re-election campaign was the closest in Polish history. He won with 51% of the vote. His challenger was a former mayor of Warsaw. He lost with 49%. And, you know, Duda really ran on a very conservative, Catholic cultural message. And the people outside of the cities, they were the ones who pretty much brought him over to victory.
Yes, this was the east and south of Poland. Again, the rural Poland was victor here. And look, there's no denying this is a big election. This guy's going to be until what? 2014, 2015? There's a five-year election. Jarosław Kaczyński, who is the real founder of the Law and Justice Party, together with his, I believe it was his brother, who was killed in a plane accident, you know, which... You know, they blame on the communists, set up this party, which is a very interesting phenomenon. It's populist, nationalist, and culturally very conservative. This is a party, they don't like Western values. They don't like gay marriage. They don't like abortion. In terms of the cultural message, this is very much like, you know, Putin's government or the Orthodox Church in Russia, although obviously Poland is Roman Catholic, but they're a world apart culturally from Brussels and Strasbourg and the Western European Union. I think this is a growing stress. Ironically, when it comes to Russia, of course, Poland is much more anti-Russia than the West, because the West really doesn't care very much. Poland obviously has historical reasons to care very much about Russia, right? So although in a weird way, the Law and Justice Party is very similar to Putin's group and sort of the people around Putin, Putin's party, if you want to put it that, in terms of their ideology, Poland is very alarmed by what Russia might do in the future and has been a primary advocate of increased or continued United States participation in NATO. I think is one of the only major countries in the European Union to spend over 2% of GDP on defense, for example. Trying to live up to their commitment. We've written a lot when it comes to the pro-natalism of the Law and Justice Party. This is one way in which Poland, along with all the Visegrad members, so this also would be countries like Hungary and Czechoslovakia. But these are the countries that are trying to increase birth rates by rewarding mothers, not necessarily by giving more options for people to return to the workplace. And we've written a lot about these very different, again, very culturally different attitudes. In other words, you want to reward, want to give bounties for women who have kids, even if they're not working, or do you simply want to make it more easier for moms to work at the same time they have kids? Anyway, very different cultural attitudes toward where these people are going. I mean, I thought I would bring that up because, after all, Christian, this is, we are supposed to sometimes actually talk about demography. So, you know, I might as well bring that out. But we often on our newswire do actually break down where the fertility rates of these various countries are going and how it's being impacted by policy. I think we have another story here on Libya, particularly how Libya is being a pawn or a being torn apart a little bit by Egypt on one side and Turkey on the other. Maybe you can give us some background on that.
Right. Well, Neil, to me, this is a little bit of a sleeper issue that no one's talking about. But a little background, Libya is in a civil war since Gaddafi fell. And there is a government in the northwestern section where Tripoli is. And they are the UN-recognized government of Libya. But the eastern and middle section of the country is controlled by this man, General Haftar. He was a general under Gaddafi. He actually switched sides and helped get Gaddafi out of power. And these two governments are fighting for control of Libya. Now, Haftar is, he's not an Islamist. He's a little more secular. And he has the support of Egypt. Well, the Tripoli government is much more involved with Islamist beliefs, and they're supported by Turkey. And what this is going, some people worry about, is there's going to be an actual conflict between Egypt and Turkey within the country. Egypt has said if the Tripoli government takes over the port city of Sirte, they will invade Libya. And this could really come to blows. You know, Egypt and Turkey have never really gotten along. It has to do with beef over the Muslim Brotherhood, which is considered by Egypt to be a terrorist organization. And they don't want the Muslim Brotherhood taking over their border country.
Yeah, this is a longstanding dispute between Turkey and Egypt. And you know, Turkey continues to provide support, for instance, to the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, you know, because they're still in the Brotherhood. And I think Egypt is trying to get the support of all the Gulf nations, particularly just the broader Arab world, against the Brotherhood. These are all the autocrats, you know, who feel threatened by them. So the idea of this could be a larger regional conflict, really, between Turkey on the one hand and these the UN-sanctioned government, which apparently is pro-Brotherhood, that's around Tripoli. And just to be clear, it's the western part of Libya around Tripoli, which is most of the population in Libya. It's most of the oil production. So Egypt is backing these groups, which, you know, go through Tobruk and Benghazi and so on around the Gulf. Not a lot there, just a lot of sand. I mean, you know, beautiful, beautiful beaches, a lot of sand. But this is an important geopolitical issue. It just came to mind, Christian, that we, I think just the last podcast, we talked about the dangers of Egypt going ahead and bombing the new dam being built in Ethiopia. So Egypt suddenly is becoming quite the player in world affairs. I did want to mention this interesting tidbit, which fascinated me because you know how much I love history, and that is Recep Erdogan is the leader of Turkey, has declared that Hagia Sophia shall be turned into a mosque. And this is really interesting. I believe that happened, I can't remember, just a few days ago. On July 15th. So I guess it was yesterday, the first Muslim prayers would be said. And this is really interesting because as many of my listeners know, I mean, Hagia Sophia, this is this wonderful church that was built by Justinian back in 537. It's one of the many reasons why Justinian sort of bankrupted the Byzantine Empire, along with his kind of imperial expeditions. But he built this enormous, colossal building, just gorgeous thing. It was the highest building in the world, I think, for another, I don't know, 8 or 9 centuries. It stayed as, you know, this wonderful eighth wonder of the world in the middle of Constantinople until 1453, when Constantinople was overwhelmed by the Ottoman Turks, taken by Mehmet, who was the 21-year-old sultan of the Ottomans. He stormed the walls, you know, overwhelmed the Genoese crossbowmen and whoever else they could find who was willing to help the Byzantines. It's a wonderful chapter in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. It's much of the last book, the sixth book, where he talks about the final fall of Byzantium. But anyway, as soon as Mehmet took it, he turned it into a mosque. So it was used as a mosque for the next 5 centuries. What changed? It was Kemal Atatürk, who was the founder of the Secular Turkish Republic, who turned it into a museum. And Atatürk clearly wanted to secularize everything about Turkey. I mean, he didn't really like the caliphate. You know, everyone was forced to shave, wear Western clothes. They adopted a Western alphabet. I mean, they did all the stuff to become Western. That was his generation. Well, guess what the generations that we would today call boomers have done, particularly with regard to the whole Islamic awakening, which has taken part in that part of the world. Guess what they're doing? They're bringing everything to bring the nationalism and the religiosity of Islam back to Turkey. And so I think one way of saying it is Recep Erdogan is trying to make Ataturk and that whole secular era an historical parenthesis, right? He wants to bring back the caliphate and the religious aspect, the Ummah, you might say, the merging of religion and politics, which really what his party stands for. And I think as a profound generational transition in the Middle East, and you're seeing it in a lot of other areas in the Islamic world today. This is how populism, maybe with a little bit of delay compared to where it's occurring in East Asia and much of the Western world, but it is definitely happening. So, you know, you'll be able to listen to Muslim prayers now. And this, by the way, has happened to many other churches around Turkey over the past year or two. Hagia Sophia was the last one. And they're obviously waiting to make that the last transition. So I think we have one last story, and that is Russia and bounties.
Right. So if you remember, Neil, there's big story in the New York Times that Putin was paying the Taliban to kill American soldiers. There's a lot of debate. Was this actually happening? Did Trump know about it? Well, right now, there's a specific investigation into a bombing in 2019. It killed three U.S. Marines, and there is some belief that this attack was a direct result of a bounty on American heads. Now, some more information's coming out. It looks like the GRU, which is the intelligence branch of the Russian military, was probably the one conducting these payments. We'll still have to get the full investigation to see if this specific attack was part of it, but it's looking like it might have been.
Yeah, well, this is the GRU is responsible for, at least they took a dominant part in the attack on the U.S. elections in 2016.
Right.
They've either attempted or successfully murdered, you know, former Russian agents all over the world. It's amazing. Putin and his regime loves these dirty tricks all over the world. And for better or for worse, he gets cover on it from President Donald Trump. I'll never forget the time, I believe this was before the election in 2016, when Trump was just thinking about being a candidate. But the Russians shot down that Malaysian airliner over the Ukraine, and Trump was there. In a press conference saying, why are people blaming Putin? It could have been anyone. You know, I mean, it could have been the Ukraine. It could have been the U.S. I mean, you know, what are we doing here? Russia has such a track record in this. My favorite is the Sochi Olympics doping scheme, you know. Right. And in athletic contest after athletic contest. Anyway, Russia delights in this stuff. And by the way, as long as we're on this subject, this was just news out this morning, and that comes from the UK National Cybersecurity Center, working with Canada, says that Russia is hacking pharmaceutical firms and universities in the US, UK, US, and Canada working on COVID-19 vaccines. So there you have it once again, and basically the NSA is basically confirming that this is probably true. This is being done by a group out of Russia called APT29, otherwise known as Cozy Bear, a well-known group, and this group also participated in the 2016 cyber attacks on the U.S. elections. Russia denies that it's doing it, of course, but Russia does have a sovereign wealth fund, which is sponsoring its own vaccine. I don't know if it's trying to gather secrets for a vaccine or whether it's simply trying to delay other people, you know. got a leg up on its own. Anyway, there you have it. And we will see how, we will see what pressure comes from the story. Obviously, I think Trump really wants to kind of slough it off and ignore it. It's very interesting when it comes to foreign policy. The president obviously has completely free hand pretty much to do what he wants. I think that's very clear in the Constitution, which is one of the reasons why I absolutely cannot understand why the Democrats tried to, you know, tried to impeach him on a conversation with a foreign leader. Of all the things to impeach, that one I just, you know, don't get. That was an extremely weak case. And it takes me back to something you said earlier, Christian, and that is whether Trump will be compelled to sanction these Chinese entities, right, and the banks that fund them. I think, first of all, he has a year, right? He has a year before he has to do it. Well, I guess that's the first question. We don't know if Trump's going to be there in a year. I do think that Trump would probably want to fight this on constitutional grounds. This is one thing that you, there's a lot of constitutional questions here. Can Congress force the president's hand, right, when it comes to that kind of executive action? I question whether Congress actually has that authority. It's like a lot of things, you know, a one-house congressional veto. There are a lot of things that Congress tries to do. This is one of those kind of veto measures. Like if we go back, we don't like how the president's implementing that, we can, you know, go back and say, well, we insist that you do it. It's unclear. I think that the Supreme Court may argue you need to actually go back and actually, you know, legislate and actually pass and have signed over a veto, if necessary, an actual piece of legislation. You can't just be in constant supervision of the president, right? That's right. That kind of abrogates separation of powers. Anyway, fascinating constitutional issue. We wanted to talk more about GOP, the Party of Outsiders, fascinating research about how increasingly the Republicans, as opposed to the Democrats, are running candidates, both in primaries and in actual elections, without any prior experience. They are winning in primaries, and they are winning in the actual elections, and it's really changing the Republican Party, and it's also leading in a very interesting way to a much more compressed age range among Republicans in the House, as opposed to Democrats in the House, who are spread over, you know, a much wider range of ages, with very elderly leadership of the Democrats in the House. You know, many of them, I think probably seven or eight of them, still silent generation, with a lot of millennials coming in on the other end. Republicans in the House, on the other hand, have a much younger leadership, 57 years old on average versus 71 years. That's a huge difference. And they have fewer millennials on the other end. So Republicans in the House tend to be, you know, late wave boomers and early wave Xers. They're very tightly concentrated age wise. And that's that group, right? I mean, they're all rebels and renegades and critics and libertarians and outsiders. You know, that's the way they love to see themselves. And I would say that's very much a generational aspect of the group that's in power there. Listen, I'd like to talk more about that, Christian, but we are absolutely out of time. In fact, we are just terribly over time. So we're going to stop it there. We have 2 weeks until I get back. We're going to do another one of these. And until then, I hope all of you stay safe out there and wherever you live, and be with you 2 weeks from now. Until then, this is Neil and Christian. Demography Unplugged. See you in early August. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hegi.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hegi. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hegi.com.